Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hello, this is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the New Yorker magazine. Every summer, from the 4th of July through Labor Day, the New Yorker Daily features a weekly series of online-only flash fiction stories. So today, I thought I'd read six of these stories, written by authors including Joyce Carol Oates and Haruki Murakami. The first flash fiction story I'll read today is entitled Hospice/Honeymoon by Joyce Carol Oates, published July 30, 2020, in the New Yorker Daily. Hospice. Once the word is uttered aloud, there is a seismic shift. You will feel it. Like a very short thread through the eye of a needle, swiftly in and swiftly out. The air itself becomes thin, steely. At the periphery of your vision, an immediate dimming. The penumbra begins to shrink. In time, it will become a tunnel, ever diminishing, until the remaining light is small enough to be cupped in two hands. And then it will be extinguished. For when hospice is spoken, the fact is at last acknowledged. There is no hope. No hope. These words are obscene, unspeakable. To be without hope is to be without a future. Worse, by acknowledging that you are without a future, you have given up. And so, when the word hospice is first spoken, carefully, cautiously, by a female palliative care physician, neither of you hears it. Or if you hear it, you don't register that you've heard it. A low-grade buzzing in the ears, a ringing of a distant alarm, an alarm in a shuttered room. That's all. For if you don't hear, perhaps it has not yet been uttered. For if neither of you hears, perhaps it will not ever be uttered. Yet somehow it happens. Hospice comes to be more frequently spoken as the days pass. And somehow it happens that your husband, surprising himself, begins to speak of his final days. As in, I think these might be my final days. As if shyly, on the phone very early one morning when he calls, as he has been calling, immediately after the oncologist making rounds in the hospital has examined him. On the phone, so that he is spared seeing your face, and you his. A new shyness, like the first initial shyness. Finding some way to say, I love you. For some, an impossible statement, I love you. But your husband managed it, and you managed it somehow. I love you. And now, years later, it is, I think these might be my final days. These words you hear over the phone distinctly, irrevocably, yet you would claim you have not heard them. No. But yes, you heard. Must have heard. For the walls of the room reel giddily around you. Blood rushes out of your head, leaving you faint, sinking to your knees like a terrified child, stammering, "What? What are you saying? That's ridiculous. Don't say such things. What on earth do you mean, final days?" Your voice rises wildly. You want to fling the cell phone from you. You can't hear it. You don't think so. Not knowing at this time the vast Sahara that lies ahead with all that you cannot bear, that nonetheless will be borne, and by you. For always, each step of the way, you resist. It is a steep uphill. It is unnatural to resist. Or if you accept the steep climb, console yourself with the thought that it is only temporary. The plateau, the flatland to which you've been accustomed, awaits you. both of you. You will return there soon. Until a day, an hour. Always there is a day, an hour, when you begin to speak of hospice yourself. At first, you too are shy, faltering. Your throat feels lacerated, as if by metal filings. Gradually, you learn to utter the two syllables clearly, bravely. Hospice. Soon after that, you begin to say these distinct, deliberate words. Our hospice. Soon, you draw up your vows. Quaintly state to yourself, as if to God, a formal decree. It is my hope I will make of our hospice a honeymoon. My vow is to make my husband as comfortable as humanly possible. To make him happy, to make us both happy. To fulfill whatever he wishes that is within the range of possibility. First, a new setting for him, not the cancer center. Our hospice will be in our home, which he loves. The atrium, flooded with morning light. The foreshortened horizon, for the house is surrounded by trees. The flotillas of sculpted clouds. My husband can lie on a sofa, staring at the tree line and at the sky, comfortable on the sofa with pillows behind him and feet in warm socks elevated. Or more likely, he can lie on a rented hospital bed, positioned in such a way that he can easily gaze out the windows. And I can lie beside him, as I've done in the hospital. Holding hands. Of course we will hold hands. His hands are still warm, strong. His fingers, when squeezed, never fail to squeeze in return. As his lips, when kissed, never fail to kiss in return. I will sleep beside my husband, holding him in my arms, not strong arms, in fact, rather weak arms, which nonetheless can be made to behave as if they were strong. I will scatter seed on the redwood deck outside the windows, not that ordinary seed, but the more expensive wild bird seed my husband purchases. Thrilling to watch the birds, taking the time, undistracted, really watching. For once. And my husband loves music. I will bathe him in the most beautiful music through his waking hours. So long as it is not uncomfortable for him, I will lie on the bed beside him, holding him, listening with him to Beethoven's Ode to Joy, Rachmaninoff's Vespers, falling asleep with him, even during the day. Even with wan sunshine slanting through the windows onto our faces, head on the pillow beside his head. From the bookcases in the house, I will select art books, his favorite artists, books from his photography shelves, Bruce Davidson, Edward Weston, Diane Arbus, Elliot Porter. I will turn the pages slowly, marvel with him. Old albums, family photographs dating back to the early 1900s. His family, great-grandparents who immigrated from the Pale, in which he has only recently shown an interest. His favorite foods? Well, I will try. When he is at home, possibly his appetite will return. When I am the one to prepare his food, his appetite will return, I am sure. Of course, family will come to visit, adult children, grandchildren, relatives, friends, colleagues from the university, neighbors, old friends from grammar school he hasn't seen in 50 years. Some surprises for him. I will negotiate with the imagination of a theater director. Not merely hospice, but our hospice. Not sad, but joyous. A honeymoon. We will be happy there in our own home, both of us. For both of us, the final days will be a honeymoon, I vow. In fact, nothing remotely like this will happen. How could you have imagined it would? Hospice, yes. Honeymoon, And now, Good Boys by Honor Levy, published July 23, 2020, in the New Yorker Magazine Daily Online Edition. We're on the rooftop with the boys. The boys are calling girls dogs, like she's a dog, a total dog. They don't mean the B word. They just mean dogs. If they wanted to tell us that a girl was a B word, they would say, she's a B word, a total B word. When the boys say something, they mean it. That's why we like them. We're not dogs. That's why they like us. That's why we're on the rooftop. The house has three floors. The ceilings are high. I know that if one of the boys fell off the rooftop, he'd die. I know that none of the boys will fall off, not tonight at least. Tonight, they're not roughhousing or drinking tequila or annoying me. They've left the tennis rackets on the second floor, and they want to tell us about their trip to Greece. In Greece, the cigarettes are cheap. They filled an entire suitcase with little yellow boxes of George Carelias and Sons. They say we can smoke as many as we want. They're proud. The cigarettes are so cheap. The boys are so proud. We laugh. Zoe laughs like Tinkerbell, the air whistling between the gaps in her teeth. She's definitely not a dog. I know we're high up. I know our lives would be ruined if one of the boys fell. But tall plants are growing on the edge of the rooftop, and I can't see the cobblestones. If I could see that little cobblestone street and the boys' little smart car, it would be easier to imagine them falling. It would be easier to remember that I'm in Paris. It would be easier to laugh like Zoe, like Tinkerbell, like a real girl, a girl who is not a dog. I can't see the Pantheon or the observatory or the park. I can see only the boys and their tan stomachs and the scrapes they got from falling off the moped. We could be anywhere. We could be back in New York or near my house in L.A. or at some Airbnb in Berlin. I'd like to go to Berlin, to dance with the boys at Berghain, to eat confit with Zoe, to see their Reichstag or whatever. But the boys don't want to go. Athens is the new Berlin. In Athens, the cigarettes are cheap. I thought Krakow was the new Berlin. The boys laugh and shake their heads. I can smell their wet puppy dog hair. The sun is setting and the sky is so pink. Pink like the canopy bed I never got. Like Kirby. Like peonies. Like the cheeks of a girl who the boys have just called a dog. I stand at the edge of the rooftop, holding my phone just above the plants, trying to take a photo, trying not to drop it. The boys tell me that if I want something to post on Instagram, they'll text me a Greek sunset. I'm not going to post anything. It's just for my grandma. They want me to show her a Greek sunset. All their grandmas are dead. In Greece, the sky gets even pinker, like way pinker. The Greeks have four words for sunset, one for each of the boys. Tomorrow, they leave to work on their barbed wire sculptures at some studio space in Normandy. Tonight, we're in Paris. But all they want to talk about is Greece. They wish they could have stayed away from Paris, from Normandy, from Bennington and Bard, from the rooftop, from all this. Their moms have ovarian cancer. Their girlfriends are pregnant again. They're sure to fail a class next semester. In Greece, none of that matters. In Greece, they sail on boats and make sketches of naked marble women and all sleep in one king-size bed. In Greece, they touch sculptures of gods. In Greece, they put their art history education to good use. In Greece, they were happy. We want them to be happy. We let them tell us about the olives and the stray cats and the monks and the night they crashed the moped and the windmills and the dead dolphin and the economy. I want to ask them how many dogs they saw. But then again, I don't really care. Dogs are girls who care. Girls who ask too many questions are dogs. Dogs' comments on how high the ceilings are. Dogs want to know who this rooftop really belongs to. Dogs ask what your dads do for work. Dogs post sunsets on Instagram. Dogs throw up when they drink tequila. Dogs beg for games of rooftop tennis. Dogs ask where the Eiffel Tower is. Dogs wear too much perfume. Dogs stink. Dogs get mad when the boys kiss me or Zoe. Dogs don't know how to keep it casual. Dogs whine. Dogs don't want the boys to be happy. Dogs want to be held after sex, to be petted, to be taken care of. Dogs make a big deal when you get them pregnant. Dogs don't know how to just take care of it while you're with your boys in Greece. Dogs are too loud. Dogs get excited too fast. Dogs need you. Dogs just don't get it. Dogs don't get to hang out on the roof. It's too high. They're too wild. They might fall. And then we'd have to catch them or something. And for the third flash fiction story today, I'll read Grayness by Sheila Hetty. Published July 16, 2020, in the New Yorker magazine, Daily Online Edition. The world could still be gray, as it was in the past, in those old movies. But then one day colors came, sometime between then and here. I think it must have been the wars. After the wars, people said, we need some reason to be less upset. Someone suggested, colors? The world agreed that colors were needed to pull everyone out of the despair of the dying and all those piled up bones. Colors were brought in. They were just carted in on trucks and everyone took their fill. It was a job for every person on the planet to put colors where they ought to be. Some things were decided in advance, like making the grass green, and you'd get a ticket if you made yours red or blue. But other things you could decide, like the color of your shirt. It was a small committee of people who made the big decisions. They were necessary, but then so was every humble individual doing their own job. The world sighed in relief. Everything was so much more beautiful now. And for several days, there were no wars, just people enjoying the colors. But humans adapt quickly to what is beautiful and nice, and then the war started up again, and the committee was disbanded. A long time ago, I was part of this committee. Not the original one, but the commemorative one, made up of the committee's daughters. We gathered to take notes about what had really happened in those conversations so that we could tell the world. We asked our fathers, what was it like to be on the committee? How did the meetings go? But they had lost their memories, some of them, and others were angry at the other committee members and wouldn't tell us why. We gathered very little information to save for the world, for posterity. And then we disbanded, too. We said to ourselves, let's just enjoy the colors. Who cares how they got here? So we did. We became just like everyone else. Not archivists of the past, but regular folks walking through the colors of the present, as if we didn't know anything. Then, one day, Amanda thought we should actually just talk to the people of the world who had participated in dispersing colors over the land. Just regular folk, the ones who did it. The rest of the daughters were tired, but I wanted to do it with her because I liked her and it sounded fun. I asked if she thought I should bring my movie camera, and she said, yes, we can make a documentary. We went to a little town and just stood in the square and accosted people who were going about their Sunday shopping and asked them what it was like when there started to be colors. And had they participated in coloring everything? We only asked the old people. Most people didn't want to talk to us, but one old woman did. She invited us back to her apartment for tea. Her apartment was full of colors, just like the rest of the world, except for one corner, which was still gray. It was her own secret corner that hadn't been colored. Perhaps the only place in the world like this. The world would have been agitated to know that a corner had not been filled in, But she said in 50 years, 60, 70, she had not let anyone in. She preferred to give up husbands and friends so she could keep one corner of the world not colored. It was clearly restful to her to have it, as restful as a little gray mouse that's a friend. Oh, she told us as she spoke for the camera, avoiding eye contact with it, her fingers playing with her teacup on her little china saucer. It was all anyone could talk about. What color are you going to make this? What color are you going to make that? Isn't it all so beautiful now? How did we ever live with all that grayness? Why did it take the world so long? Isn't it nice how we are all cooperating? She was making little sour expressions as she imitated those people from so long ago, many of whom were dead now. She had got into the craze for a little while, too, coloring everything in sight, even things that weren't in her jurisdiction to color, like the neighbor's fencing. But one day she returned to her apartment, where she hadn't yet filled in the corner. She had been coloring other things. She had just put it off. She thought, I'm tired. I'll do it tomorrow. She told us this with downcast eyes. And what happened? Well, tomorrow turned into tomorrow, as it does for many of us. It kept appearing on her to-do list, like one of those items that are there for so many months you don't even notice them anymore. And the months turned into years, and somehow she never did it. What is it with those things that never make it off the list? Is it that we actually don't want to do them? Or that we don't even need to do them? We put them on there because we think we should. Why don't we just take them off already? So finally she took it off. And by that time, the world didn't even have enough color left that she could use it to fill the corner anyway. She stayed in that apartment. Various friends encouraged her to move, for the immigrants were moving into her building. And so her friends thought that she ought to move. But although she wasn't a fan of the immigrants, she didn't mind them so much. They were nice neighbors, and that dull corner reassured her in a funny little way. She looked at it every day as she took her tea. No, she didn't have anybody over, and yes, her lovely immigrant neighbors thought she was a snob. But really, what was she supposed to do if one of them found out and said something to somebody? She couldn't take the risk, and so she didn't take the risk. She finally stood up to let us out, very, very sadly. She told us to please not air our documentary or write about it until she died. She wanted to live with that little corner like that until she died, and not be taken away or to jail or for somebody from some committee to come and color it in. So we agreed, because we felt sorry for her, and we liked her. Well, she finally died last year, and next week our documentary airs. But we are sad about it. Mostly we wish we hadn't been waiting for this anniversary, the one-year anniversary of her death, with the sort of desire everyone feels to show the world what they've made. We're proud of the short film we created, and that we found this story, but not that she had to die in order for us to put it into the world. Better that she had lived, and lived with her corner, than that we got to show our film. Why is there always so much sadness when something good occurs? A balance between the good and the bad. Couldn't she have said, show your film to the world, and felt safe that no one cared any longer about one little corner not being filled in? No. But perhaps she knew something we did not about colors and grayness and corners and what is allowed to you in your privacy, in your tiny little apartment, and what is not. And now, The Kingdom That Failed by Haruki Murakami, published August 13, 2020, in the New Yorker Magazine Daily Online Edition. Just behind the kingdom that failed ran a nice little river, It was a clear, lovely stream, and many fish lived in it. Weeds grew there, too, and the fish ate the weeds. The fish didn't care whether or not the kingdom had failed, of course. Whether it was a kingdom or a republic made no difference to them. They didn't vote or pay taxes. Makes no difference to us, they figured. I washed my feet in the stream. A short soak in the icy cold water turned them red. From the stream, you could see the walls and the tower of the castle in the kingdom that failed. The two-colored flags still flew from the tower, fluttering in the breeze. Everyone passing along the riverbanks would see the flag and say, "Hey, look at that! It's the flag of the kingdom that failed." Q and I are friends. Or should I say, were friends in college. It's been more than 10 years since the two of us did anything that friends do. Which is why I use the past tense. Anyhow, we were friends. Whenever I try to tell anyone about Q, to describe him as a person, I feel totally helpless. I've never been very good at explaining anything. But even taking that into account, it's a special challenge to try to explain Q to someone. And when I do try, I'm overcome by a deep, deep sense of despair. Let me make this as simple as I can. Q and I are the same age, but he's about 570 times more handsome. He has a nice personality, too. He's never pushy or boastful, and he never gets angry. If somebody accidentally causes a problem for him, "Oh, well," he'll say, "I've done the same thing myself." But in fact, I've never heard of him doing anything bad to anyone. He was well brought up, too. His father was a doctor who had his own clinic on the island of Shikoku, which meant that Q never wanted for pocket money. Not that he was extravagant with it. He was a smart dresser and also an impressive athlete who'd played interscholastic tennis in high school. He enjoyed swimming and went to the pool at least twice a week. Politically, he was a moderate liberal. His grades, if not outstanding, were at least good. He almost never studied for exams, but he never failed a course. He really listened to the lectures. He was surprisingly talented on the piano, and he owned a lot of Bill Evans and Mozart records. His favorite writers tended to be French, Balzac, and Maupassant. Sometimes he'd read a novel by Kinzaburo Oh, or another writer. His critiques were always right on the mark. He was popular with women, naturally enough, but he was not one of those anyone-he-can-get-his-hands-on type of guys. He had a steady girlfriend, a pretty sophomore from one of the fancy women's colleges. They went out every Sunday. Anyhow, that was the Q I knew in college. In short, he was a character without flaws. Back then, Q lived in the apartment next door to mine. What with lending salt or borrowing salad dressing, we got to be friends. And soon, we were at each other's places all the time. Listening to records, drinking beer. Once my girlfriend and I drove out to the Kamakura shore with Q and his girlfriend. We were very comfortable together. Then, during the summer break of my senior year, I moved out, and that was that. The next time I saw Q, almost a decade had gone by, I was reading a book by a swanky hotel pool near the Yakusaka district. Q was sitting in the deck chair next to mine, and beside him was a beautiful, long-legged woman in a bikini. I knew right away that it was Q. He was as handsome as ever, and now, just over 30, he evinced a certain dignity that he hadn't had before. Young women walking by gave him a quick once-over. He didn't notice me sitting next to him. I'm a fairly ordinary-looking guy, and I was wearing sunglasses. I wasn't sure whether I should talk to him, but in the end I decided not to. He and the woman were deep in conversation, and I hesitated to interrupt them. Besides, there wasn't a lot that he and I could have talked about. I lent you salt, remember? Hey, that's right, and I borrowed a bottle of salad dressing. We would have run out of topics quickly. So I kept my mouth shut and stuck to my book. Still, I couldn't help overhearing what Q and his pretty companion were saying to each other. It was a fairly complicated matter. I gave up trying to read and listen to them. "No way," the woman said. "You got to be kidding." I know, Q said. "I know exactly what you're saying. But you've got to see it my way, too. I'm not doing this because I want to. It was the guys upstairs. I'm just telling you what they decided. So don't look at me that way." "Yeah, right," she said. Q let out a sigh. Let me summarize the long conversation, filling in a good deal by way of imagination, of course. Q seemed to be now a director at a TV station or some such place, and the woman was a moderately well-known singer or actress. She was being let go from a project because of some sort of trouble or scandal she had become involved in, or maybe just because her popularity had declined. I don't know. Anyway, the job of informing her had been left to Q, who was the person most directly responsible for day-to-day operations. I don't know much about the entertainment industry, so I can't be sure of the finer points. But I don't think I'm too far off overall. Judging from what I heard, Q was discharging his duty with genuine sincerity. "We can't survive without sponsors," he said. "I don't have to tell you that. You know the business." "So you're telling me that you don't have any responsibility or any say in the matter?" "No, I'm not telling you that. But what I can do is really limited." Their conversation took another turn into a dead-end street. She wanted to know just how much he had exerted himself on her behalf. He insisted that he had done everything he could, but he had no way to prove it, and she didn't believe him. Yeah, I didn't really believe him either. The more sincerely he tried to explain things, the more a fog of insincerity came to hang over everything. But it wasn't Q's fault. It wasn't anybody's fault, which is why there was no way out of this conversation. It appeared that the woman had always liked Q. I sensed they had got along well until this business came up, which probably only added to the woman's anger. In the end, though, she was the one who gave in. "Okay," she said. "I've had it. Buy me a Coke, will you?" When he heard that, Q breathed a sigh of relief and went off to the drink stand. The woman put on her sunglasses and stared straight ahead. By this time, I had read the same line in my book a couple of hundred times. Soon, Q came back with two big paper cups. Handing one to the woman, he lowered himself into his deck chair. "Don't get too depressed about this," he said. "Any day now, you'll..." But before he could finish, the woman threw her full cup at him. It caught him square in the face, and about a third of the Coca-Cola splashed onto me. Without a word, the woman stood up and, giving a little yank at the seat of her bikini, strode off without a backward glance. Q and I just sat there stunned for a good 15 seconds. The people nearby were staring at us in shock. Q was the first to regain his composure. "Sorry," he said, and held out a towel to me. "That's okay," I answered. "I'll just take a shower." Looking slightly annoyed, he drew the towel back and used it to dry himself. "Well, at least let me pay for the book," he said. It was true that my book was soaked, but it was just a cheap paperback, and not a very interesting one at that. Anyone who threw a Coke on it and prevented me from reading it was really doing me a favor. He brightened up when I said that. He had that same great smile as always. Q left at that point, apologizing to me once more as he stood to go. He had never realized who I was. I decided to give this story the title "The Kingdom That Failed" because I happened to read an article in the evening paper that day about an African kingdom that had failed. "To see a splendid kingdom fade away," it said, "is far sadder than seeing a second-rate republic collapse." This was translated from the Japanese by Jay Rubin. Next up in this flash fiction extravaganza is Ruth, Frank, and Dario by Laure Segal, published August 20th, 2020 in the New Yorker magazine Daily Online Edition. The February ladies' lunch met at Ruth's Riverside Drive apartment, so it was for her to set the agenda. You remember how we said that we're the five people to whom we tell all our stories? Well, I have a story for you. Great, said Lottie. Good, said Farrah and Bessie. A number of stories, Ruth told them, and at the end there's a puzzle. Good egg, said Bridget. Ruth said, there was this party at Sylvia's that turned out to be a Shiva for Sylvia's aunt. Lottie and I were there, said Bessie. Ruth said, and Sylvia came over and asked if she could get me a chair. I told her, thanks, very kind, but I'll find one on 90, she said. Get you a drink, she said. I told her, Sylvia, I can manage. The cane is for balance. And I should stop fussing and go away? You don't have to go away, I said. And we laughed, and Sylvia said she hoped it was okay that she had given Frank my number. He was dying to talk to me. Frank? Which Frank is this? Ruth, you know, Frank James. Frank James, yes. Oh, I think it's that I think of him as James Frank. Sylvia said Frank works in a gallery on Bleecker Street and wants to know about your old buddy, your client. What was Dario Di Alessi? Anyhow, he wants to talk to you. So why didn't he walk over and talk? Sylvia said he's afraid of you. I was annoyed. That is such nonsense. What does it even mean? Where is he? Over there, said Sylvia, walking out the door. It had irritated her, Ruth told the friends, to find herself waiting for Frank to call. The prospect of telling her old Dario story, she said, and opened up a window onto such a chunk of time. She called Sylvia and asked for James' number. James? Sylvia said. Which James is this? Frank, I mean Frank James, who wants to talk to me. Ruth had dialed and hung up because she couldn't think at that moment whether it was James or Frank. Frank. She dialed. Frank, this is Ruth. You're asking about Dario Di Alessi? Has started all these stories in my head. Frank said, well, that's what I had hoped. God, that's what I want. I Googled you. You were Dario Di Alessi's lawyer. I was, she told him. There was a paperwork to do with the people who he hired to fabricate. Fabricate, that was the word, one of his sculptures. I got to go upstate with him into this sort of hangar where men were working on a 20-foot black curl. I was never happier. I loved listening to the craftsmen talking with each other. God, Frank said, how did you meet him? Ruth said, I was one of the groupies who hung around whenever he came to New York. Years later, I visited him in the Italian Alps, in his place. It was like a Mesa Verde cave dwelling, if you can imagine a Bauhaus cave carved out of the Italian mountainside. Did you know him? Me? Nah, Frank said. I saw him once coming out of a restaurant on East 17th, and I walked behind him for a number of blocks. He went into a grocery, and I watched him through the window. He came out, went into a liquor store, came out with a bottle. Then he got into a bus going west. Ruth told her friends, I had the thrill of thinking, so that's what Dario did on the way over to my place, like watching a scene happening 30 years ago. But then Frank said, I was just 20, too young and shy to go up to this man and tell him that I loved his show. So that must have been Dario's first exhibit, years before the one at the Guggenheim. Before I even knew him. I told Frank that Dario might have been grateful. Dario used to talk about the desolation of that early success and his first New York visit before he knew people. Frank said the gallery had just acquired a Di Alessi called Hatch. I remember the bunch of us sitting with a bottle of Malbec trying to come up with a name for the new Di Alessi piece to replace Untitled. It had to be what Clement Greenberg called a word independent of meaning. In the days when our favorite cartoon was of a museum goer wiping a tender tear in front of a Russian constructivist painting. You don't know till how you try how hard it is to think of words that signify no object or feeling or value. I'd wake up in the night with a sense of triumph. Bout. But that means strife. Upstanding got shot down because it commented on its opposite, standing down. There are so many stories, I said. Frank said that I was a resource and asked whether he could take me to lunch. But the day of the lunch, he called for a rain check. Major snafu at the gallery. I've invited him up for a drink. The March ladies' lunch met at Bessie's. Frank James had not made it to Ruth's for the drink. Someone from the gallery called. Frank was out of state and would call as soon as he got back. The friend said, "Tell us the DLSC stories you were going to tell Frank James." Ruth said, "Here's something I didn't understand when I was visiting Dario. I called his attention to a man, a farmer, sitting on the pavement in the village square with a little goat on his lap. The man held the animal's hoof the way you might hold a child's or a young girl's hands." Dario said, "He's going to take the little goat to be slaughtered," which I always remembered after the way you remember something that doesn't add up. Ruth said, "Dario took me on a climb. He climbed like a mountaineer, one foot after another at an even pace. I impressed myself by overtaking him. Then I had to sit down and recover my breath while he moved steadily on and up. And the terrifying drive up the mountain road to see the oldest houses on the highest range. You have to understand that Dario was the world's worst driver. On the way back, we ran out of petrol. Because you are statistically more likely to come upon a wayside shrine where someone plunged to death than a gas pump, the locals, unlike Dario, drive with a spare can of gas. Dario and I sat with the car door open, and we sat, until the milkman's truck tootled up the road. The milkman siphoned off enough gas to get us back to Altamonte. Dario took out his wallet. I had had enough Italian to understand that the milkman said, 'No, no, no, no grazie, signor Dario, no ce mi faccio un grafo.' I wondered how many upstate New York milkmen would prefer a de Kooning or a Wathco signature to a couple of 20s. At Ferris' lunch in April, as Ruth reported that Frank James had canceled another appointment, the friends began to smile. One of those spring colds that are so famously hard to shake. Farrah asked her, "Is this getting to you? Are you annoyed with him?" Ruth said, "I would have said no way except that I'm telling you about it." Bessie's husband, Colin, was not well, so she did not come to the May lunch at Lottie's. Frank had had to go and get a grown son out of some snafu and hadn't made it to the latest appointment. Here was the puzzle. And it engaged the five friends' powers of speculation. Lottie said, "First thing, if someone tells you they have a snafu, a cold, a son, is to believe them." Ferris said, "One can imagine a 20-year-old too shy to approach a man with a famous name, but what stops the middle-aged New Yorker from crossing the room to speak to a woman?" "An old woman," Ruth said, "at a New York party. A New York Shiva," Ruth said. The June ladies' lunch met at Bridget's. Frank had not made it to Ruth's place, and Bridget said she had a story. "I asked my delightful 20-year-old niece, Lily, if she remembers refusing to come into the house if my 90-year-old mother was in. Lily says she remembers that my mother wore the earpiece of her glasses across her ear instead of tucked behind it, and she had been spooked. She remembers crying and not wanting to come in." "Lily was how old?" asked Lottie. 6 years, maybe." "And how does that throw a light on a grown man not talking to Ruth at a party?" "At a Shiva," Ruth said. Bridget said, "Just another story that doesn't add up." The ladies' lunch met back at Ruth's early in July, before everybody had dispersed for the summer. No, Frank had not come. Frank had called, and the friends smiled. Frank said that there was a fire in the apartment next to his apartment. The friends laughed. Bridget said, "Maybe there was a fire?" "It's possible," Ruth said. For the final piece of flash fiction, I'll read Director's Cut by Edgar Carret, published July 9th, 2020, in the New Yorker Magazine Daily Online Edition. Maciej Smolanski was a filmmaker, entrepreneur, and philosopher. But above all, he was a perfectionist, which was why no one was particularly surprised when he announced that his new film, Life, would be shot on three cameras and would correspond minute by minute to a human lifespan. Filming began with the birth of Matusz Kratoszewski, the film's introverted protagonist, and lasted 73 years. On the set of the final scene, in which Matusz hangs himself in his basement after being diagnosed with late-stage prostate cancer, the entire crew wept. Not even the sound man's desperate shushing could stop the tears. Post-production took 114 years. Maciej died of old age a few months after it started. Sound editing continued for another 96 years. And still, when the film was released, there were several complaints on social media that it was rushed and sloppily done. All the leading film critics were invited to the premiere, and the few tickets offered to the public were sold on the black market at exorbitant prices. The film, as promised, was 73 years long. When the closing credits rolled and the lights came on, the ushers found that, with the exception of one viewer, the entire audience was dead. Most of them were giving off a pretty good stench. Among all the decaying corpses sat the lone surviving viewer, naked and balding and sobbing like a baby. When his tears finally stopped falling, he wiped his eyes, stood, and walked calmly up the aisle. This aging man was the son of a famous film critic who hadn't even known that she was pregnant when she sat down to watch the film. He was born 8 months into the screening and grew up in the dark cinema, transfixed by the screen. When he opened the doors and stepped out into the street, he was blinded by the sun. Dozens of reporters waiting outside the theater thrust microphones at him and asked what he thought of the movie. "Movie?" he stammered as he blinked at the sunlight. All along, he thought it was Life. I'll end today with a piece from the question and answer section of the September 12th, 2020 edition of the New Yorker Magazine Online Edition Daily. It's entitled Racism, Contagion, and the Dangers We Pose to One Another by Isaac Schottner. In her book On Immunity and Inoculation from 2014, the essayist Eula Biss examines the varying, complex reasons that many Americans and people all over the world distrust vaccines. Biss charts the way that we've been taught to think about inoculation, as well as the language we use to describe it. She connects the fears that we have about vaccines to larger concerns about the environment and government. And she gives a hearing to the parents who refuse to believe that their children's health could affect the health of other children. As in much of her work, including an earlier essay collection on racism, Notes from No Man's Land, Biss goes to great lengths to understand different points of view, but can be withering about the danger of certain ideas, above all, the desire to ensure that our bodies and our behavior are natural. With hope rising about the availability of a coronavirus vaccine within the next several months, I recently spoke by phone with Biss, whose latest book, having and being had, examines the intersection of consumption and happiness, and her own adventures in homeowning. She explained that On Immunity was a jumping-off point for her latest work. The psychology of capitalism is actually robbing us of something, Biss said. One of the things we're being robbed of is our ability to trust other people. We need that in order to keep other people and ourselves safe. It's really destructive to the social fabric. During our conversation, which has been edited for length and clarity, we discuss the best way to talk to vaccine skeptics, the connections between racism and contagion, and why she finds something beautiful in the idea of herd immunity. First question. What is the biggest challenge we face as a society in terms of getting to a place where people feel comfortable taking a vaccine? I've been thinking about this as I watch this whole thing unfold, and I feel like we're living through the plot of Jaws right now. One of the big problems is that the mayor keeps saying everyone should go to the beach, even though we all know there's a shark in the water. I think once that happens, you've broken trust or lost trust. In the book on immunity, I was thinking a lot about the role of trust and how trust is earned and how trust is lost. It was already clear back then, when I was writing in 2010, that there are problems that are specific to places where there's really low faith in government structures and public infrastructure. One of the problems right now that I think we can see coming is that when people don't have faith in their government and don't trust their government and don't feel like decisions are being made in the best interests of people's health and lives, it's going to be hard for them to trust a vaccine that the government had had a hand in making or testing or distributing. But we need the government for testing and distributing vaccines. I think we're setting ourselves up for a bind. Your book talks about why there is skepticism about vaccines, especially in foreign countries that might be victims of dictatorships or imperialism. But you also point out, in America, skepticism about vaccines often comes from educated, white, privileged people who you'd think would have generally good reasons to be trustful because, broadly speaking, life has been good to them. How do you understand that paradox, if it is one? Well, I'm not entirely sure it is a paradox. I think there are a number of different things going on there. I think for some people that skepticism of vaccination or resistance to vaccination really is an expression of or an extension of a privileged attitude, a sense of I'm going to let other people take this small risk and their risk taking will protect me. I think that's a quintessential thought pattern of the privileged. Let others do the work for us. Now, that's not going on with everyone. I think that that's one of the things that gets lost when we reduce conversations about vaccination to pro and con, and when we think about an anti-vaccine stance as a homogeneous position. A lot of the people I talked to when I was working on that book, and most of them were women, were well-educated. Many of them would point to historical events or realities when they talked about their own vaccine skepticism. Some of them pointed to things like the Tuskegee syphilis experiment. That was, for them, a reminder that the government has engaged in medical testing that hasn't had its citizens' best interests in mind. Also, people would point to an entire history of misogyny and sexism in medicine and the way in which women's bodies, knowledge, and professionalism has been marginalized in that space. I think there are many anti-vaccine positions that are coming from awareness. That doesn't mean that the smart or socially aware thing to do is not to vaccinate. I think that the suspicions and lack of trust are raised actually by a historical awareness, and that the way to address those suspicions and fears is with a really rigorous and transparent system for safeguarding the health of people who are getting vaccines, and to be rigorous and transparent about the way vaccines are tested and monitored. So, then, how should we be talking to people who are skeptical about vaccines? I would say your book is fairly respectful of people with different views, but also at times cutting about the substance of those views. I don't know. I'll just start by saying that. My project in this book was inspired in part by feeling condescended to as a woman and a mother by a lot of the material that I read about vaccinations when I was pregnant and when I was a new mother. I smelled a strong whiff of misogyny in a lot of the media coverage and even in medical literature. There was an undercurrent, sometimes it really wasn't that subtle, of this idea that if only women weren't so dumb and so bad at understanding science, then this wouldn't be a problem. My commitment was to write a book that didn't reproduce or echo any of those misogynist tropes, to write a book in which I directly address other women with respect for their intelligence and capacity. I do very strongly believe that that's how any conversation around this should proceed. I also think there's a special challenge here and a special opportunity. Vaccination really, for many diseases, works best not just when a majority of people do it, but when everyone does it. It's one of these few places where we really need to make a consensus decision. I don't think we have a lot of practice in this majority rule structure that we're in of making consensus decisions and of what that requires and what kind of conversation leads to a consensus. I think it's already pretty obvious that finger-pointing and name-calling and insulting and damning conversation is unlikely to lead to consensus. We do have to find a way to talk about this, a way that will allow us to reach the kind of decision that the technology actually demands. We need everyone to be on board. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. Couldn't finish that interview, but I hope you enjoyed it and that you will be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Would love to hear from you. Well, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.